All right. Everything's
Look
good?
great.
Okay, darlings. Good evening to all. 10 o'clock in the night here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Nice, cool night. It's a warm night. I got my air. It's warm. But it gets very chilly here in the morning because it's in the desert, you see. So it gets like 10 degrees in the morning and then like 100 degrees, 80, you know, it's 30 degrees in the daytime. It's very interesting weather. Okay, where are you all? There you are. Okay, darlings, let's go. Hello, Doris. You're up in the middle of the night. No, you're late, Doris. Aren't you? Yeah, this is. It's late for you. I know. It's 1 in the morning for her. Gosh. Okay. Okay, so I thought we'd talk about the mind. Seeing as it's the mind that gets happy and the mind that suffers, and there's the mind that gets angry and the mind that gets loving, and it's the mind that drives the body and speech. As I said, they're the servants. So let's talk about the mind. Because, I mean, we can all say the word mind, but each of us will have a different interpretation, you know? So we'll look, let's look at the Buddhist view. It's quite distinct, quite unique, actually. And I mean, and that's the thing, we can, many of the words are similar. So we can easily just give our own meanings to it, which is perfectly fine, but you won't really understand Buddhism if you don't understand the Buddhist view of the mind. It's really, and it's utterly central to everything. I mean, in the Buddhist view, everything comes from the mind, as abstract as that might sound to us, you know? So it's understandable, even theoretically, what it is we're talking about. Well, first of all, like I said, you know, crucial point for the Buddha is that it's not physical. It's not a function of the brain. I mean, without insulting neuroscientists, I would say that the brain is a physical indicator of what's going on in the mind. But of course, only at the very gross level, because, you know, we don't assert these subtler levels of mind that Buddhism does. And if we can't even posit these subtler levels of mind, then Buddhism just makes no sense. It's just a load of nonsense, you know? It really is. So we have to understand theoretically what the Buddha is saying the mind is. So, I mean, as Holiness said, you know, in a commentary on Mahamudra, and I want to talk about that here, Mahamudra, we'll do a little meditation. It's easy enough to know all the theories about the mind, but to actually experience our mind directly, that's quite subtle. That's quite advanced, you know. So we can, the best we can do is at least start with the words. So first of all, it's not physical. It's not a function of the brain. It's not a function of the body. But that doesn't mean it's not intimately connected to the body. It clearly is. And certainly in the Vajrayana, like I said, in the kind of postgraduate teachings, which are really quite helpful to understand the mind, there's this inextricable relationship, you know, inextricable. We've got gross consciousness, then we have subtle consciousness, and that's the only time we function there is when we dream. But we can develop that part of us when we meditate. And then even what we've got, what they call very subtle consciousness, which is the subtlest level of our mind. And only the greatest meditators can access that level. That's the goal in the end, you know? So, and then linked to those different levels of consciousness, different levels of cognition, because that's what the mind is, it's the capacity for cognition, is gross body. So here, this bag of bones is connected to the gross consciousness, which is mainly our senses, you know, our sensory consciousness. So then we've got subtle consciousness. That's our mental consciousness. And then at the subtle level, the subtle level of physicality as well. Clearly, that's not how we talk in our culture, you know, in our modern science. But obviously, it's similar to the Ayurvedic system. It's similar to the Chinese system. Like I said before, there's this subtle physical energy. And this is what the Tibetan medical system is based on, this incredible knowledge about the way the mind is in the subtle body. They feel your pulses and they can feel the relationship between, you know, they can feel the subtle wind energies coursing through these different thousands of channels in your body. And they know that these different states of mind are connected to those different winds. And this is how they talk in the Vajrayana. And when we really understand this relationship, also, it really helps us understand karma. It's very interesting, you know, because everything the mind does impacts upon the physical, and whatever the physical does impacts upon the mind. They're inextricably linked, you know. So this is what, but that the mind finally is the one that's the boss. We don't feel like it now. We're complete victims of the body. We're victims of the external circumstances, but we have the power to develop our mind to the point where it can be in complete control. I mean, to degrees that really would sound to us like science fiction. But it's all in the literature, it's all there. And a lot of this is coming from these Indians well before the Buddha, 3,000 years ago, you know. We have to remember that. So, okay, the mind is not physical, but it's intimately linked to the body. First point, fundamental. Second, it is not the handiwork of anyone else. This is, like I said before, that's a very odd idea for the Buddha. The more you become familiar with the Buddha's teachings and try to internalize them and use them as your path, which is what you choose to do if you choose it, then you know it's really the weirdest idea to think that your anger, your love, your compassion, that your mind itself, that your very being can come from someone else. This is just too peculiar for the Buddhist view. So it takes a while for us to get used to it, because that's what we completely believe in our culture. You know, we just completely assume, you know, mother and father made us, God made us, whoever. I mean, Buddha's not being rude when he argues with these views. He's just got a very different view. So then the other, and the real implication of that already is so powerful. Even if you don't even think about karma, already just think, you know, that your anger and your love and your being good at football or music, they're yours. Own them. Take responsibility. It's a very powerful idea. It's a really fundamental point. So so then, you know, and like we've talked many times, if you know, some of you were familiar with each other. When you study Buddhist psychology, the Buddhist model of the mind, which is coming from these Indians well before, it's highly developed, highly, you know, it's quite sophisticated view, quite unusual view, and quite extensive view. It's very fascinating the way the mind works, you know. First, you have the epistemological model of the mind, and this already is very powerful to understand how the mind functions. The second one is the psychological model, and that's the contents of the mind, your thoughts and feelings and emotions and unconscious and subconscious. And we need to become intimately familiar with that, because as Lama Zopa says, that's where the workshop is. That's the work of being a Buddhist. That's the unique approach of the Buddha, and that's what we have to understand, the contents of our mind. First of all, the neurotic, deluded, I-based, fear-based states of mind, all the ones we're so familiar with that the Buddha has found amazingly are not at the core of our being and can be removed from the mind utterly. Second, we have all the virtuous, positive, valid states of mind. They're the source of our happiness, the first lot of the cause of our suffering, and the cause of why our dumb body and speech do things to harm others, and then the cause of our future suffering. And then the third lot, you know, they're simply called neutral, but that's a misleading term for us. But really, I like to call them the mechanics of our mind. And this is a really crucial thing to understand, these three categories, because it's not how we talk in modern psychology, not how we talk in neuroscience. So, you know, we know very well there are lots of states of mind. One, for example, we call concentration. One is called good memory. That's what we call mindfulness. Although in the West, we got made up all these fancy names for what we think mindfulness is. But it's really the capacity to not forget what you're doing moment by moment. You've got many of these. You've got one called discrimination, which is the ability every second it's working to discriminate between this and that. Every second, you know. You've got one called alertness. You've got one called, there's many of these, many, many. And these, I call them mechanics, because whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you need these to function. If you're a sniper, you need very good concentration. You need very good memory. You need very good discrimination, because if you get the wrong person, you're in trouble. You know, and if you're a meditator, you need them as well. So it's in that sense that Buddhist psychology will say that they are neither negative nor positive, in the sense that the first lot are the negative, neurotic, deluded ones that cause suffering, and the second lot are the virtuous, positive, optimistic, beneficial ones that cause happiness. So there's a very particular meaning to negative and positive. Don't get all neurotic and kind of punitive about it. They've got very particular characteristics. It's a very specific approach. And there's only these three categories. You've got thousands of states of mind, but they all fit into these three categories. And our job as a Buddhist, so this is the point that's so logical. If the end result is to achieve Buddha, if the end result is to get rid of the rubbish and grow the goodness, it is absolutely a no-brainer that the job is we have to learn to distinguish between them. That's the job of being a Buddhist. That's why we have to know our mind. That's why we have to have eventually single point of concentration. I mean, we just have to. It's just no question. It's not enough just to know how you feel, which is usually the body. It's not enough. It's too gross. It's much too coarse a type of awareness. We have to learn to have this concentration, and then learn on the basis of learning this model of the mind very precisely. You learn this incredibly sophisticated job of the ability to distinguish moment by moment what the hell is going on in this mess in our mind. At the moment, it's a big soup of emotion, and we can't tell one bit from another. But that's our job. That's our job. We leave it till way too late. We leave it till the wheels fall off, and then we're having such mental breakdown, we just can't handle it. And that's why we go get a pill. And that's our trouble when we understand meditation. When we have all these weird ideas about meditation in our modern culture. One is, you know, we think it's an alternative to a pill, and we only want to do it. And this is a fascinating point. You know, if you're in love with Fred and you're all getting along beautifully and everything's perfect, you've got 2.5 kids and the house is lovely and there's no COVID-19 anywhere and money's in the bank and everything's gorgeous, and someone says you should learn to meditate, you go, what for? I'm happy. So we look at the assumption we have about meditation. It's like an alternative to a pill. Because we've heard, one, it makes all the thoughts go away because we can't cope. This is not the point of meditation. It's kind of naive and absurd to think that. Second, meditation is not a relaxation technique. Yoga has wonderful relaxation techniques. We need relaxing. We're all neurotic. Do them. It's fantastic. But it is not meditation. Not for the Buddha. So clear. Meditation is not to you know, just to make all the thoughts go away and feel and get some kind of vision, to have a spiritual experience. It's how we talk about it, you know. It's so just weird. It's a training. There are two kinds of meditation in Buddhism, thousands of techniques. But once you got it down, there are two modes of meditation, two ways of using your mind in meditation. And the first one comes from these Hindus. It's not even Buddhism in its nature. It's the Hindus. I mean, they're happy to share it. Buddha, when he diverged in his own direction, you know, he very happily took it with him. And it's a central, real technique living. And the people, you know, if we're all white Australians, you know, as opposed to maybe being from Asia or India, and we all think, oh, it's these, you know, Asians who do the meditating. No, there are people like looking like you and me now, up in the mountains, this second, metaphorical mountains or actual, achieving single point of concentration. This incredible technique that's a living, in an unbroken 3,000 years of training. It's an extraordinary, skillful psychological technique. It would blow our minds if we really understood what it is. We have all these kind of wishy-washy views about it, the 47 varieties of mindfulness, not really knowing what it is, making up our own trips. So that's okay. Buddha's not a boss. He doesn't own this stuff. But if we're going to call it Buddhist meditation, we better know what we're doing, you know? So this technique, the first kind is concentration, is learning to get this subtle focus of the mind to a level of subtlety that we don't even posit as existing in the modern world. That's the point. So we've got to really open our minds to this, you know? We're not discussing the brain here. This level of cognition does not need a brain. It's a level of cognition that's subtler and is beyond the physical and beyond the grosser level. So when you've accomplished this single point of concentration, you know, you would look like you're dead. There's no brain functioning. But so, of course, we don't think you're alive because we only posit the grosser level that depends upon the brain. So we have to recognize that limitation. Nothing wrong with it, but it's a different view of what the mind is. We have to posit this as a possibility. And so this is something, you know, this technique is necessary in the long term to do the job the Buddha says we can do, to go into the mind at a much more subtle level, sort of to get this kind of like microscope of our mind that's super capable of distinguishing in a level of clarity. I mean, I'll read you a bit from Lama's Mahamudra, this beautiful book of Lama Yeshis that came out last year, I think. Mahamudra, How to Discover Our True Nature. It's very delicious and very inspiring. I hope you've got it in your shop, have you?
Yes, we do, but shop's not open because of COVID.
No, I know, there you go. But it's a really special, wonderful book. It's a more advanced practice, but on the face of it, it seems a very simple practice. And it is in its nature technically simple, but to accomplish it, of course, is not simple. But nevertheless, it's very wonderful. Lama's always so inspiring, you know. So in there, Lama talks about the mind. So let's talk about he doesn't talk much about the, you know, the contents of the mind. He talks about the way the mind functions. Because Mahamudra meditation is... Okay, let me finish. There's two modes of meditation in Buddhism, okay? The first kind is concentration, known in Sanskrit, the end result called calm abiding in English, calm abiding, known as shamatha, you know? That's the end result when you've got this concentration to some degree. There's still subtle levels. Then you've got the second mode of meditation, which is known as vipassana, which means insight. So, okay, there's a type of meditation in the world, which is one of... You know, Buddha taught many kinds of vipassana, many kinds of techniques to help us get insight. But there's one particular one that's known generally in the world as vipassana, and it's almost like its own religion. And it's okay, I'm not complaining, just saying. But there are many kinds of techniques that Buddha taught on the basis of getting concentration. You use that focused mind in the second mode of meditation to get insight. So insight into what? Well, he wants us to get insight into how things exist. He wants us to get insight into how things are impermanent. He wants us to get insight into karma. We've got to get insight into everything. But we've got to become this very narrow view that insight is this particular meditation where I think, you know, I've never done it. It's one of Buddha's one of his first teachings he gave about how to meditate to get some understanding of insight into impermanence. And the technique is to use your concentration to focus on the different sensations in the body. That's known generally in the world as vipassana. And it's Buddha's technique. It's wonderful. But the thing you're trying to get insight into, and this is a big mistake people make because we're so addicted to our bodies, we think we're trying to get insight into the way our body works. No, ridiculous. Nothing to do with that. It's using concentration on the sensations of the body to get us to get the kind of knowledge, that guess what, folks, things change. Buddha wants us to get insight into impermanence. That's the function of that one. But the one we talk about in the Mahayana, which is taught in the Bodhisattva path, the second mode of meditation, we want to get insight into ultimate reality. That's subtler. And there's many that Buddha taught. So the first one is you've got to get some focus, concentration. Then you use that concentration in a very skillful way to do your meditation. The second mode to get insight into. So Mahamudra is a particular style of meditation that you get your concentration, but the object of your concentration, the typical one we all do in the world, is you concentrate on your breath, because your breath happens naturally. So you anchor your mind to your breath, and that helps you get your mind become steady. I mean, that's the plan, you know? I mean, don't hold your breath. So don't hold your breath because you've got to meditate on it. You've got to focus on it. But the point is to get the mind to focus. And then the second, so in Mahamudra meditation, what's so delicious about it, Lama talks about it, is that the object of your focus is your mind itself. And this is a tricky one. We'll do it. We'll do a few minutes just to try. It's a really nice meditation. But it's more difficult. It seems easy. Instead of focusing, your breath is easy to locate. You can feel the air moving in and out, and you anchor your mind to that. That's simple. Then you say, then this one is, you first meditate, you try to, the first step in the meditation, you just concentrate on whatever pops up in your mind. One of the commonest experiences is people say, well, nothing popped up in my mind. What am I going to look at? You know, I'm getting very confused. But that's the job. And eventually, when you get used to this meditation, your mind becomes much kind of quieter a little bit, hopefully. So then the main object of your concentration is called the clarity of your mind, which is its own, just its pure, its kind of unphysical nature. And she talks about in this book, because it's a commentary on one of the Panchen Lama's texts from the 17th century, and it's a Gelug tradition. He talks about Tsongkhapa's, reason why this is such a marvelous meditation to do, because the mind has got is so extraordinary. The way Buddhism talks, we're not discussing the brain. Remember, we're discussing the actual subjective cognitive process of your thoughts and feelings and emotions, not the body, but the mind. And it really takes practice to try to get used to this. And so, given that we have to become familiar with our mind, I mean, what a marvelous technique to do. You can't help but notice what's going on in there, and that's what we have to learn to do in day-to-day life. So this Mahamudra, so Lama talks about how one way of talking about the mind, again, this is not how we talk in our culture, that the mind, the mind functions, they refer to the mind as like the subject, and subjects always have an object. So the object of mind is that which it cognizes. So the object of the senses, for example, and this is what you learn in the epistemological model of the mind, which is very tasty. It really gets us to be very clear about how our mind is functioning. So in the epistemological model, you learn that we've got the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose, tongue, taste, the five sensory consciousnesses. This is already very powerful to understand, okay? This is not Mahamudra now, it's just the general mind. This is already very important to distinguish the capacity of your sensory consciousness from the capacity of your mental consciousness. They're completely distinctly different. But we kind of just merge them as one big lump, We just think, I am cognizing something. So we've got to be much more precise. So this is very, very telling. The sensory consciousness, your eye consciousness, is only capable of cognizing two things. Shape and color. So this sounds kind of boring, but it's very meaningful. Like, if I say, and I'm always using the same example, if I look at that thermos, because I'm attached to shape, I chose that one because I like the design. So when I look at that with my eyes and I say, oh, that's a really well-designed thermos. Everybody, we can be forgiven for thinking that my eye consciousness cognizes a well-designed thermos. Well, don't be ridiculous. Your poor old eye consciousness is like a dumb animal. It doesn't have that capacity. So what does it cognize? If it cognizes shape and color, only shape and color. So the obvious question, and this is really the point about the Buddha's view of the mind, obviously, you've got to ask the question, what part of my mind is cognizing a well-designed thermos? Well, guess what, folks? What's happening is this. Quicker than Google, the millisecond your eyes land here, because everything's stored in my memory, I haven't forgotten, up comes it instantaneously, my mental consciousness, and Tibetan's point here, interestingly, not the brain, up down here, my mental consciousness is accessed, and in a millisecond, and I may really mean it quicker than Google. I mean, the way Lama Yeshe talks about the brilliance and the brilliance of the capability of the mind to cognize things is fascinating. So we've got this sensory eye consciousness, shape and color, that's it. Instantaneously, my mental consciousness, which is where my memory is, not everything is stored there. That's where the workshop is, as Lama Zopa says. Nothing's gone astray. Then up comes a concept, an opinion, a viewpoint. Ah, what a well-designed thermos. So that's a bunch of concepts I have stored in my mental consciousness. And then, of course, this is, and then because, so everything in the mental consciousness is a bunch of concepts. We function at different levels. Another one in the epistemological model, we learn that we've got sensory and mental, two separate parts of us, sensory and mental consciousness. Sensory is the bare bones of the eye consciousness, which is the part of your mind, remember consciousness is not physical, that functions through the medium of the eyeball to cognize shape and color. Ear consciousness cognizes sound. It does not cognize divine Miles Davis. It cognizes mere sound. And then the millisecond at the same time, if you, you know, if your mind's quick, up all those concepts in my mind. That happens so quickly, it's like in the millisecond altogether. But there's a whole process that goes on. I hear that sound, my memory recognizes it, my discrimination, my this, my that, all doing their job. I hear it, I go, Miles Davis, trumpet, wow, song, you know, kind of blue, whatever. All that is thoughts, concepts, conceptual stories in my mental consciousness. So now mental consciousness has two levels of functioning. The grosser level, which is literally conceptuality. And that's the level we function at in day-to-day life. And then the other level is subtler, and that's called perception. In Buddhism, it's got a very specific meaning, or non-conceptual. We don't even posit a level of non-conceptual mental consciousness because we live at the level of thoughts. Now, that's what's a shocking thing, though. This is the point, that when we say in our world, we go thoughts up here, then we go feelings down here. All of those, as far as Buddhist psychology is concerned, are rooted in conceptual stories. And all those conceptual stories are divided into three categories. Negative, neurotic, deluded, or the parts of our mind that are absolutely not in touch with reality, that exaggerate, that distort, that embellish, that add up, that add bells and whistles onto things, that are rooted in the root delusion called ego grasping, which believes in an inherent me, which is the biggest load of rubbish. Then, and they are deeply, painfully disturbing, and they're rooted in fear. Many people say, you know, when you read the list of different states of mind, when you study Buddhist psychology, where's fear? Well, you know what? You don't need one, because all delusions are rooted in fear. All delusions, that's their flavor. They're living in panic and fear. We're living on the edge of panic and fear the whole time. And all we try to do is kind of allay it, you know, by having a nice cake and a nice boy and a nice this, trying to divert ourselves from our mind. We don't pay attention. So no wonder we have berserk all the time. No wonder we get out of control because we're not paying attention to it. So all the neuroses, which we think are at the core of our being, I mean, no wonder we're depressed. They're just natural. Natural means you're unnatural if you didn't have them. The Buddha says we're all mentally ill. These are called delusions, afflictions. There's lovely this word in Sanskrit, klesha, translated in Tibetan, and then English, affliction. You must have read it in many Buddhist books. Oh, I have an affliction. Who uses that word? It's medieval, you know. Lama Yeshe never used it. He's amazing. Lama, I think Mama was born a hippie. I swear to you, he's unbelievable. When you read how Lama taught back in the 60s and 70s when he first met Westerners, it's like, I mean, when you hear Tibetans talking, even if they're really modern, it's like really quite different way they construct things, a different way they kind of conceptualize things. It's a very different way of talking. Lama Yeshe somehow just knew how to talk to us. He was mind-boggling. I can't get over it, you know, when I edit his teachings. So in this book, Mahamudra, he never uses the word affliction. He just knew it was a dumb word. And he made up, he's got 21 different synonyms. He makes up his own terms to try and get us to understand the functioning of these crazy states of mind that we consider natural, which means you'd be weird if you didn't have them. I mean, no wonder we're all wacky, you know. And the Buddha's view is they're all conceptual stories. Now, the second category, love, compassion, wisdom, kindness, generosity, they are valid states of mind. They are not rooted in fear. They are not coming from the neurotic eye. And they are also the conceptions, because we live at the conceptual level. And when you read the epistemological model of the mind in Buddhism, it is mind-bogglingly fascinating how conceptuality works. It's so abstract, it's so unusual. And these genius yogis, back since the Indians before the Buddha, they have unpacked and unraveled and mapped the mind. They understand it intimately, and we all can too. It's remarkable, the view, I tell you, of the mind. It's so fascinating. And this is what we have to become familiar with. That is where the workshop is, as Lama Zopa says. This is being a Buddhist. Controlling your body and speech, a good Muslim, a good communist would do that. That's common to the world. But this is where you become a Buddhist and you get to high school. Once you've subdued your crazy body and speech, you can then start to see your mind. And using the Buddhist model, it's so important to study it first. Because then it's just using our definitions of these words. It's very fascinating, I tell you, most interesting. So the mind is the subject, and it cognizes. So by definition, to have a moment of cognition, you need a thing that is cognized. So the object of mind. So whatever exists in the outside world, all the sensory objects, they're objects of cognition. And whatever the conceptual mind thinks about or feels, whether it's anger or kindness or 1 + 1 = 2, they're all cognitive. It's all conceptual stories. And then we have to divide, we divide them into the neurotic, delusional, disturbing, fear-based, up, you know, up the creek without a paddle states of mind that cause you suffering and misery that we can get rid of. The second lot are valid. These are the core of our being. Love, compassion, wisdom, kindness. They are at the core of our being. They can be developed to perfection. This is a very different view, and it's very fascinating and very encouraging. Because as we start to become familiar with our minds, they're not going to go overnight, I promise you. Do not wait. Do not think that meditation is to make them all go away. Eventually, as you're a very sophisticated practitioner, you will subdue the conceptual level, yes. But we're going to be at this level until we're highly advanced and get used to it and start becoming familiar with it all and then start to make friends with it all. So you can learn to distinguish the crazy roommates for the good roommates. You've got to do that job. And then you become more brave in your wishing that it all go away because you can't stand the pain, you know. So the mind is the subject. And as Lama Yeshe said in the talks in Mahamudra, the way the mind functions, and this is very surprising to us, this is not how we think, how we cognize things. The mind is like a mirror. As Lama Zopa said, and this is indicating this point, the way that the world out there appears back to us, in other words, is reflected in the mirror of our mind. And take these words quite literally. It's not how we think. It's very fascinating. Every second that we're awake, our cognition is working overtime. We're seeing and hearing, tasting, touching and smelling and having opinions about things. But our tragedy is, because we're so addicted to our different conceptual stories, and they are called attachment, it's a conceptual story that over-exaggerates the deliciousness of something. Anger or aversion or annoyance or irritation or frustration, there's a spectrum, all on the spectrum of aversion. They exaggerate the ugliness of things. And all the different, you know, qualities, all the different states of mind have their own job, their own function. They function in a very particular way. So we're constantly seeing and hearing and tasting and touching and smelling. And then our mental consciousness is running rampant and having opinions about everything. So that the neurotic ones are invalid opinions. It's not moralistic. It's practical. They're not in touch with reality. If you're seeing something through the lenses of your attachment, the thing will look more delicious than it really is and will blind you to seeing other things. If you're seeing something through the lenses of your aversion, things will look more ugly than they really are in reality. But the tragedy is this. We don't think, when I say, well, that's a really well-designed thermos. Now, it might be. It might have won the blue ribbon in the show, in the Brisbane show, as best designed thermos. You could argue that. It's possible. But we never think. I don't think that's an opinion. I think I'm right. I think it is, in its bones, right there, a well-designed thermos. And I'm going to argue with you if you disagree, and I think you're stupid. But that's how we live our lives. There you go. No, mine's much prettier than yours.
No, mine's much
prettier. There you go. So we don't realize, but anger is an opinion. What is anger saying, you know? I mean, where's my boyfriend? Who's my boyfriend? I've got no boyfriends here. There's no men.
There's a few.
I can't see any on the front. My front page, all female. Marius is down there. Marius, I'm sorry, you're my boyfriend, okay? So I'm going to be rude to you now. Oh, there's Jan. His Jan is there too. So I'm going to be rude now, Marius. So if I'm in love with Marius, we all know this, you know? That means attachment is running rampant. That means first of all, attachment is multifaceted. These are the three poisons, okay? We're talking about the negative states of mind, and we're talking about the mirror of my mind, and we're talking about Marius being this person, being the object of it, reflecting back into my mirror. So if attachment is in my mind, I'm going to discuss this more in a minute, it's coming from my own emotional hunger. It's an emotional hunger that feels less than I really am. So I'm quite convinced when I find the boy, you know, I'm going to find the boy. He's going to make me happy. And it's this junkie in me that overestimates his deliciousness and then expects him to make me happy and then begins to possess him. It's multifaceted, this attachment, and it's so primordial we don't even notice it. And so I would never think it's an opinion. When I tell you I'm in love with Marius, he's so handsome, he's so divine, he's this and he's that. But if you know, even if I meet his ex-wife who thinks he's a creep, I think she's just plain stupid. We don't think it's an opinion. I know the truth, and she's just a really dumb person. We all think this way. This is the fundamentalism of the way we are, because we come into this life programmed with our tendencies. So we never, ever even, first we don't even think we're having an opinion. So then why would we look at our mind? But the Buddha says they're all opinions, they're all viewpoints, and some of them are invalid, some distort, and some are valid. So good, grow the love and grow the compassion. So in my mind, at the same time as my attachment, fortunately, I've got some love for Marius, otherwise I'd eat him for breakfast and spit out the bones. So it tempers my attachment, aren't I fortunate? And they're the virtues. But for us, it's just this big soup of emotion. I can't tell the difference. So there's my mirror of my mind, my own cognition, and then out there via my senses, and then all my mental conscious going berserk, having its opinions. So attachment is this over-exaggeration of Marius's deliciousness, over-exaggeration of his capacity to make me happy, and like this hubris of this entitlement, this attachment. He'd better make me happy. It's his job. We know this one. We know this one. So then my mirror is completely distorted. It's like dirty with attachment. So who Marius is, I'm not seeing the whole picture at all. He might have good qualities. I'm not wrong, but I'm not seeing properly the person. I'm as blind as a bat. I can't see anything wrong. When you've got attachment, you can't see anything wrong with something. But what happens is, because attachment is not a valid view of Marius, you know, eventually attachment starts to get bored. It starts to sort of wane. And so then I'm going to start to find fault. And before you know it, I look in my bed one morning, who's this ugly bloke? Get the hell out of here. Because now attachment's completely turned into aversion. So all I see now is the bad qualities. And we all know this. We go like from pillar to post between attachment and aversion. And that's an extreme and obvious example. The chocolate cake is the same. Before the first piece of chocolate cake, it looks divine. By the fourth piece, it looks repulsive. We know this, but we don't join the dots. We never learn from it. We never see it. We just go, oh, this is normal. And this is what Buddha says is what being in samsara means. The mind running berserk like this and utterly unaware until our body's experiencing something. And then when we get, you know, and then things go wrong, we get devastated. So we've got to become super, super, super sophisticated in our job of knowing our own mind at levels that we do not even posit in the materialist view of the mind, I have to say. And the interesting point about the Buddha's view of the mind, he doesn't care about the object. He's not interested in what Marius did to me. He's not interested in whether Marius is kind or ugly. We obsess about the object. So we go, oh, I'm allowed to be angry. Marius did that. And it's also with attachment. Look, it's Marius's fault and I'm so happy. Look at it. It's his fault. He's so divine. What can I do? You know, we blame the objects. Buddha's deal is we've got to become familiar with the mind. He's so direct. Not the object. We don't have to look back at what a mummy did and daddy did. Don't need to do that. Wasting your time. Look at your mind. And by working on your attachment now, that purifies your previous attachment. And you get to see yourself more clearly. But the point I'm getting here, one point, is the mirror. So if the mirror's dirty or if the mirror's broken, it's obvious whatever's reflected in it is crooked. I mean, think of a body of water completely still. The tree on the bank of the river, it appears exactly correctly, isn't it? Is reflected exactly in that water. But if the water is turbulent, how does the tree look? And this is the point. We don't realize our mind is merely reflecting. It sounds so peculiar to us. We don't realize we're merely reflecting what's out there. And as Lama Zopa says, what appears back to us in the mirror of our mind is in the aspect of what's in our mind. I mean, we sort of know this. Look at people who are really angry all the time. They're always seeing problems, always seeing fault, always seeing ugly people. They're paranoid, seeing dramas everywhere. We know this. Patient people always sort of, oh, it's okay, everything's fine, I can handle it. So it's so evident, but we don't join the dots. We don't get the learning from it. And the key, and as Lama Zopa says, this is very shocking and I often quote it. Because we pay full, I'm adding this piece, because we're so obsessed with the outside and so believing that Marius is the cause of my happiness and my suffering and so frantic to get the objects or push the objects away that we don't pay attention to the mind. And as Lama Zopa says, this is very shocking, you know. The vast majority of all humans on this planet have absolutely no idea that what goes on in their mind plays any role at all. I mean, that almost seems impossible to believe, doesn't it? But it's true because we're so obsessed with the outside. But I would add to that, not only do we not know that what goes on in our mind plays any role, we don't know what goes on in our mind, period. And why should we? We don't think it's necessary. Because everything is the outside. It's the outside's fault. So if you think of it this way, you know, I blame Marius if he's mean to me for making me suffer, but I'm also blaming him for my happiness. Look, it's like the chocolate cake. You know, you think about the chocolate cake, just the simple old chocolate cake. It looks so delicious on that plate, doesn't it? When your stomach's empty and you can't believe this divine cake. That's why we find it so hard to say no, because it just looks like so delicious. You can't believe this deliciousness vibrating on the plate. And it's like begging me to eat it. So it's kind of like, what? It's not my fault. I mean, look at that delicious cake. You know, we think it's not my fault. That's how we think. Like these victims, you know, we're compelled to put the cake in the mouth. That's how we see each other sexually. I mean, this is not against men, but it's a very good story. It's a very example of this. When I was living in London, when I was in my, whatever I was, when I was a radical, what was I? Feminist, I think. Yeah, feminist. And my policy was, I don't know why women don't do it now. I don't see many women punching men in the nose on the street. And it was my policy back then, that if any man said anything about my body, because you're allowed to these days, it wasn't politically incorrect, you wouldn't get arrested. There were no Me Too movements, you know. So men did whatever they did. And it's not against men. I've been a man many lives. I don't not take it personally. But I mean, I had a very nice chest, right? And I was kind of, I had hair and nice chest. And men seem to like these pointy things on the chest. God knows why. I think they're boring. But anyway, men think they're great. We know that. I mean, that's, get my point. Anyway, I was walking down the street in Soho in London. And this bloke, an old fellow, said something about my chest. And my policy was I would abuse the guy. Often I'd punch him in the nose or punch him in other places and insult him and embarrass him on the street. It was just my policy. I didn't try to be mean. I just thought, you know, how dare they say something about me? So this fellow, I was rude to him and he nearly burst into tears. He was so upset. And this is what he said. And get my point though. It's not about feminism. He said, but if you don't want me to say something, why do you look like that? Now, that's how we think about men and women, women being the sex objects. But that's exactly what attachment thinks. It blames the object. You think about that. It's very powerful. We blame the object. Well, if I'm supposed to give up cake, don't, you know, keep the cake out of my face, please. It's my cake's fault. What can I do? Poor me. Look at me. That's how we feel. That's how we are driven by attachment. And then we're driven by anger. How dare you do that to me, isn't it? It's very fascinating. So anger and attachment are such simple words, but they have a profound level of function in our minds. And if we can begin to understand attachment and aversion the way Buddha talks, we have a deep understanding of Buddha psychology. I'm not kidding. You have a deep understanding of yourself and you have a deep understanding of other people. And this is not how we talk in our modern psychology, that's for sure. They sound too simplistic, you know, but they are really quite profound. And the thing is, these three poisons, as they call, the summary of those 84,000, the three toxic emotions, the root one, ego grasping, known colloquially, ignorance, simply known as maripa, unawareness, it's the most primordial. It's the root problem, such that when it's uprooted, you're out of samsara, babe. You're on the way out of samsara, you know? You cut the root of suffering. So the root one is a primordial misconception that posits is about the very ontological status of your own self. It's so primordially subtle, so deep, so instinctive, it's almost, even when we hear about it, it's hard to even identify it. Then on the basis of that neurotic sense of a separate, bereft, concrete, solid, pointable, very unhappy me, then it gives rise to its main voice, this hunger, this mass, first of all, this massive dissatisfaction. I am just not enough. That's the irony of ego. So then, of course, it's emotional hunger to get something to fill up the gaping hole. And that's its main function. It's looking for something out there every second. Every second, every second is driving everything we do, say, and think. Every second, throughout the day. And its main one, and then when it gets the object, whether it's the cake or Marius or just a nice sound or whatever, or gets what's what you want, it's then we call, you know, it's we think that's attachment getting what it wants. And then we possess it and hold onto it and don't want it to go away. And it's 1,000 times a day this is going on. So the key function of attachment, being very, very brutal about it, it's this deep, frantic, desperate craving to get what I want every millisecond. And what it means, what I want is what is the nice things, my opinion of what's nice. So it only can cope with the nice things. It can only cope with what I think will not make me happy. It's frantic, and every second, and the millisecond it doesn't get what I want, the millisecond it gets what is not nice, then that is the arising of the third of these three, and that's bare bones is called aversion. So aversion is, ugh, go away. Attachment is, ooh, that's nice, and you go towards it, you know, quite instinctively. So aversion has, again, is multifaceted. It's the obvious volatile level is called anger. shout and yell and scream. But there's a milder levels, and this is where our problems are. 99% of us have these, but we do not pay attention because the wheels aren't falling off. They're called irritation, upset, frustrated, annoyed, anxious, worried. They're all variations of thwarted attachment, or, you know, they're all variations of aversion. But we don't pay attention. It's only when you're yelling and shouting, and or internally, the other extreme on the other end of the spectrum, the internalized version of aversion is called depression. You can't get out of bed one morning, you're inert. That's internalized anger. I mean, don't hear, oh, what am I angry with? Don't even think that way. It's thwarted attachment. Because it's guaranteed, because attachment is a lie. It's a misconception. It's a distortion. It's an exaggeration. It can never get what it wants. Because when it gets what it wants, then you're dissatisfied again. You want something else. You can't be happy with it. So it's never ending, bottomless pit of dissatisfaction. So when it doesn't get what it wants in the day, like, you know, just ordinary, you might be a really nice person. And this is what I'm talking about. You don't all shout and yell. That's my trip. You know, shouting and yelling. I'm trying to calm down. Maybe I'll calm down before I die. We'll see what happens. Anyway, some people don't shout and yell. And you are the ones, it's much harder for you to see aversion because you're a nice person. And there's nothing wrong with being nice, but you can't see it. It's evident when I'm shouting and yelling, you can't pretend it's not that, you know. But when you're more quiet because you're a nice girl and you don't ever shout and yell, we don't notice the attachment, which is constantly being thwarted. And then it just brings this unhappy feeling, and those feelings build up. And that's a key thing in Buddhist psychology that's very important to understand. We think just thoughts go in one ear and out the other. No, nothing goes astray. Everything is stored. Like Lama Zopa said, it's like we're taking photos all day, and throughout countless lives, we've been doing that, and the negatives are stored, the imprints are stored in our mind. So everything is stored there. Nothing goes astray. In one day, when 99% of the day we're not paying attention, as many moments as there are in that day is as many thoughts that have been stored in your mind. You get annoyed, a bit irritated, a bit upset. You don't even say anything. You don't even notice. No one else notices. But they all build up, and one day you can't get out of bed. You're inert. And then you think you better go to a therapist or you die. Or you scream and yell. That's the wheels falling off. We just wait too late to notice because we don't pay attention to the process inside. And it's way more subtle than we ever imagine in our culture. You know, it's a very fascinating view of the mind, I tell you. Very amazing. And because it's my mind, I have the power to know it. So as Lama Zopa says, this mirror of the mind, Lama Yeshe talks about in Mahamudra, you know, whatever is reflected back to me, and that's the entire world all day, is distorted by this mirror. And then we don't think it's a mirror. We don't think we're reflecting anything. We just think what I'm seeing is true. We would believe what I'm seeing is true. We believe, you know, it's like you know that you think 1 + 1 = 3, and you believed it for so long, it looks like 1 + 1 = 3. Or you believe that pink is black. You've believed it for so long, it appears black to you. You don't know you're making a mistake. That's how deep these delusions are. And we come programmed from the first second of conception, programmed with these misconceptions. And our virtues, they're our saving grace. And we have to make the distinction. That's the job of being a Buddhist. And it's hard work because we can't bear the pain. That's the problem, you know. But we have to have courage. We've got to delve in deep and welcome all these maniac roommates and identify them exactly and know that they're only thoughts. They are thoughts. They are merely thoughts. It's incredible. But look at the pain they cause us. Look at the panic we get, you know. So we've got to have a lot of courage to see our minds. We need a lot of courage, knowing we won't go crazy. It's okay, you know, we can handle it. And then we know that the negative ones are not at the core of our being. This is unbelievably encouraging. Then we can have courage to confront them and see them and hear their stories. And then, you know, and the more deeply we go into our mind, the more we can hear the conceptual stories, these elaborate conceptual stories of these states of mind. Ah, this is our job. Slowly, slowly, we get better and better at this, you know. But you've got to control your servants of your mind first. Shut your mouth, zip your lip, and keep your hands to yourself. Pretty powerful practice already, you know.
Venerable, can I ask, even if I've done the tiniest bit of study about this attachment thing, still I've noticed what my mind does is it basically says, oh, yeah, but this one's different.
You mean the object?
Yeah, that's right. I know all about it. I know it's just a projection, la, 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 but this time it's different. Or if
the way more I'd say it is, you know, you kind of, you know the cake didn't make you happy yesterday, but you're convinced this time it will. And I think, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
All it is just habit. We're so addicted. That's all we've got to understand. The word addiction is really good in the West. But the point is, we think I'm normal, way down the other end of the addicts. But no, Buddha says, you've got any attachment, baby, you're a junkie, you're an addict. And that's the point, because the addiction is, the habit of them is so strong that even though we know that the very thing that made me, that looked delicious yesterday, called the chocolate cake at the beginning of the eating of it, was the same thing that did trigger pleasure, that as I kept eating it, eventually caused me to vomit. We know that, but the next day we conveniently forget it and we get all excited again and believe this time it'll make me happy. That's the killer, isn't it? That is the killer. So that's why the habits are strong. We know that. So we've got one of the key practices is you can't stop the attachment from coming. I mean, it's really when you highly realize you're going to go beyond attachment. Don't even pretend. We've got to really recognize it's a very deep disease and we've got to learn to live with it and work with it and harness it, you know, and add virtue on top of it, especially in the bodhisattva path. But when we understand that, the more we can hear the thoughts and begin to unpack the feeling of attachment and hear the conceptual story that is driving it, the more we can then begin to not believe it, even though we're going to still follow through, we won't believe it's true. That's a powerful practice. You can't make it go away yet. You got to deconstruct it. And then the first step is to not believe it. It's a story in there that'll tell you that Mars will make me happy. And you know, and you got to not believe it. And that's hard. That's what's hard. So then you be more tempered. And that's where, if you're going onto the bodhisattva path, there's different levels of practice, right? If we're trying to practice the bodhisattva path as well, I'm going to have a relationship with Marius. I've got to be conscious and recognize, distinguish the attachment from the love. Love is a virtue. Love is under the second heading. Love is, may Marius be happy. Love is a good state of mind, a valid state of mind. I've got to grow that one. That's got to see Marius and go beyond I. Attachment is a voice of I, self-centered. Love is a connection with another. So they're going to be both there together, and I've got to learn to distinguish them. So I can't just wait to love Marius when I've given up attachment, because that'll never happen. You've got to just work with it. You've got to be brave enough to risk it. So you've got to know that your job every day is to distinguish between the attachment, which is this deep hunger, this neediness, this expectation, this belief that when he says I'm gorgeous, that makes me a gorgeous person. All this neediness and hunger that's in there, which is attachment. I've got to start seeing it for what it is and learn to temper it, learn to listen to what it's saying, learn to not believe it. Of course it's hard. Of course it's hard. But at least add love on top. And then with the food, I mean, with our food, I mean, we mightn't, you know, I mean, I don't have boys anymore. I don't have many other things anymore. I've got a bald head and one set of robes, you know, $10 budget a year, clothing. So not much to get attached to there. I like my shoes though. I'll get different pairs of shoes. Never mind. I'm just joking. The thing is, I mean, you know, attachment, you know, I distracted myself from my stupid jokes. What I was going to say, I can't remember. I can't remember. So, okay, the first level of practice is there's no wriggle room. Just control your body and speech, please. Just back off, control your mouth, control your body, and begin to harness the servants of your delusions. Then you get more sophisticated, and the second level, still in the wisdom wing, you start to control the delusions. There's no wiggle room there either. Just try to not feed into the attachment too much. You control yourself with your cakes. You control the boys. You control those things. You try to harness the attachment. Then you get to the bodhisattva path, and you're trying to actively grow love and compassion here. That means you're going to have a relationship. Then you add love and compassion. So even with your food, you know, one in the very first level of practice, one antidote to having attachment to food is just think of it as caca or vomit. And I'd always think, well, how stupid? Why would I do that? I won't eat it. Well, that's the point. You're trying to get up attachment. But we don't want to do that. So what you can do is this is why Lama Zopa always stresses the bodhisattva path. You're going to have your cake. You can have your cake and eat it too. So before you shove it in the mouth, you know, which is going to be driven by attachment, you add some virtue to it. You have bodhicitta. You think of it as empty. You offer it to the Buddhas. You create huge virtuous thoughts there. And that tempers the attachment. Well, then the same in my relationship. I can't just have a relationship and give up attachment. I wouldn't have a relationship if that's the case. I'd go become a nun or go to the mountains. So if you're going to enjoy a relationship, it's going to include attachment, but you add love and compassion to the mix, and that tempers the attachment. It's very skillful, very wise, but you've got to see your mind and see the difference. And that's every second of the day. Realizing, and when you really start to see the deep hunger of attachment, when you're in love with a person, it's like desperate, you're frantic. This attachment has gone mad, you know. I'm not discussing the pleasure. That's another discussion. That's something where we conflate attachment with the feeling of pleasure. No, they're separate parts of our mind. Attachment is an absurd, exaggerated, demented, I-based you know, unhappy state of mind. Pleasure is just pleasure. There's nothing wrong with pleasure. The more pleasure, the better, dear, as Ramayeshi says. But we conflate them, and that's a really big mistake. It's wrong understanding of the mind. We've got to be very clear about these things. So attachment's huge. But you just learn to, you see it and learn to not buy into it and say it's a, know it's a lie and analyze. Because you know from yesterday that excitement and anticipation, which is function of attachment, to get the cake. Just the cake, forget the Marius. So excited, you forget, you just become blind, you shove it in the mouth, so excited, you know. And then 4 pieces later, and you're burping and would vomit if you ate a 5th piece. We know it. In other words, the same thing that gave you pleasure is the very same thing that gave you, what made you vomit. So you've got to, you know, remember that, and then have a more nuanced, more calm understanding of the cake. Not be so fooled by it, you know. That's a practice. Meanwhile, you can leave it there. You can say your blessing. You can, and then you can eat the cake and try and notice the pleasure and enjoy that and even offer the pleasure. That's very beneficial then. It's very beneficial. Any more questions, Emily?
There is one from Alicia who wanted to ask about, you know, when you said about, you know, zip your lip and yeah. keep your hands. So what about yeah. speaking up against racism or intolerance or harmful views?
We're not discussing, that's compassion wing, okay? That's compassion wing. So we've got to see the different levels of practice. It's so important, Alicia. The first level of practice is, you know, the first and second levels of practice, junior school and high school, the wisdom wing, you are the beneficiary. This is about your personal practice. You've got to control your body and your speech, meaning don't say angry words, don't say jealous words, don't say loud words, don't hurt people, don't lie, don't abuse, don't badmouth behind backs. That means controlling your speech. Not because someone's going to praise you as a good girl, because you don't want the suffering it'll cause you. It's a really practical thing. It's to help you harness your crazy behavior, because you don't want to be unhappy. It's nothing to do with helping other people yet. That doesn't even come into it yet. It's learning to control your speech that's driven by delusions. You don't control your speech that's driven by virtue. More of that, please. Come on. If you want to say loving words to somebody, say it. That's compassion side. Here it's harnessing the behavior that's driven by your delusions, and you're the beneficiary. Then next level, you start to look into your mind and you're dealing with harnessing the delusions now. This is all your work. This is your inner work. Now you're prepared to get to the compassion wing. And now you look around the world, go, oh my God, look at the whole world. They're all suffering. Look at this. So that's when you practice compassion. But if you have got an uncontrolled body and speech, an uncontrolled mind, your compassion will make a mess. It'll just come out all vomit. You'll shout and yell, and it won't do any good, and no one will listen to you. So you've got to control your body, speech, and mind first. Then that calms you down. And this first stage of practice is you have to see your own suffering. And that's something we often miss in the West. We don't think we're suffering because we're not poor or not, you know, being racially vilified or something. You know, we're misunderstanding suffering. And so we've got to understand the Four Noble Truths, where there are different levels of suffering. So the first kind of practice is all, it's like the retreat mode. You work on yourself. That qualifies you then to see your own suffering and be sick of it and stop the causes of it. And now you go, oh my God, we're all in the same boat. Look at the world. And now you can be qualified to use your speech and use your behavior to be of benefit to others. It won't just be driven by attachment and anger. If it's just driven by attachment and anger, it makes a mess. It feels good for 5 minutes, but you make a mess, you know. I remember Martin Luther King saying this. I mean, it's really clear. So if you see some people who are politically active, some just get very angry, and we think it's so cathartic, you know. But they end up making a mess and alienating everybody. But Martin Luther King, he was so incredible person. He was clearly a patient person. He didn't have anger. Or this wonderful John Lewis, this, you know, congressman who died finally, who was around the same time. All those years he worked, he said that the only solution is love and blah, 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 you know. He was an incredible human being. He did not get angry. This is sublime, actually. It's amazing. Well, Martin Luther King said, I'll never forget, he said, it's good to find fault. You know, we think, oh, you can't be angry, or you can't say there's any racism, or you can't say there's sexism. That sounds being angry. No, it's called intelligence. We have to distinguish between finding fault and being angry. There's a big difference, and we don't see the difference in our culture. So he says, it's good to see things wrong, but then you say, what can I do to help? That's courageous. Then they suffered so badly. Look at them being beaten, being imprisoned, but they were not angry. That's profound. And as His Holiness said one time to some journalist, the journalist said, anger looks like it's really productive. you know, in these types of things. And he's honestly said, I know what you mean. But when things mainly are motivated by anger, you don't, it doesn't last. It runs out. You give up. But it was driven by compassion. Look at Martin Luther King. Look at John Lewis. They never gave up. In other words, the key here is to be clear about the way Buddhism describes the character of the neurotic states of mind. They're I-based, they're destructive, they're not beneficial. They're, you know, and this is where, when you're in Tibet, I always remember one of my friends, Jigdrol, a monk, 30 years ago, he told me about how he was in the 70s, his mummy and daddy had babies, and they decided, no, in the 60s, they had first had their babies, and they decided to make many Tibetans. So they had 13 babies. You know, because they can't catch up with the millions of foreigners in Tibet now. Anyway, he was involved in the first kind of mini uprising in Tibet since 59. It was in 1987. And he was telling me about it. And he's, you know, all these thousands, it was monks and nuns who were the radicals who were demonstrating, you know. So when we think demonstration, we think anger, you know. But no. He was telling me about how he got arrested, and then he got tortured, then he got released, and then he demonstrated again. Then his friend had his head blown off, and then he thought he'd better escape. So he came to Nepal over the mountains, and he came to Kathmandu, and he's at Kopan Monastery. And he was telling me about all this, and then he told me since he left, his father got murdered, brother got murdered, and he was sad, and there were tears. And I said to him, Jigdrol, do you ever get angry? I asked sort of casually, and he laughed. Casually and said, angry? What for? It's our own fault. I mean, this is karma. We haven't talked about karma yet. But this is a point that's so ingrained in the bones of the beings of Tibetans. It's been in their worldview for 1,200 years. In the same way that we completely take it for granted that our mind is the brain and we're physical and mummy and daddy made us, they have this view in their mind coming from India, you know. It's just in their bones, that everybody's Tibetan. And that's why they don't have much anger. This is very fascinating. We really start to analyze anger, I tell you, it's very fascinating. The philosophy of attachment and anger. When you have the view of karma, you know that you brought yourself with you. You know no one made you. You know whatever's in your mind, and crucially, whatever happens to you, good or bad, is the fruit of your actions. You just naturally take responsibility. So that means, look at how we suffer. This is what's so fascinating for us. Look how we suffer. We mainly suffer when bad things happen that we didn't directly cause. And that's a lot of our suffering in this life. And that's due to past karma, Buddhism says. All our happiness is also due to past karma, but we never worry about the happiness. We never ask, why do good things happen? I've never had anybody ever ask that question, because we love the good things and we can't stand the bad things. So our suffering is, why is that happening to me? That's where we go mad. And that's the philosophy of anger. So anger is the philosophy that says, on the basis of attachment, I didn't ask to get born. It's not my fault. So naturally you ask the question, which is what anger is. How dare that happen to me? And then that's what our compassion is based on. How dare you do that to those poor innocent victims? So our compassion now is based on anger, because we have the view that we're all innocent victims, that we didn't ask to get born, and that bad things happen unfairly. This is a misconception, Buddha says. It's hard to hear this. Got to unpack it and really look carefully at the whole philosophy. Because if you have the view, like Jigdrol, that you brought your mind with you, that everything that happens to him, every second of his happiness is the fruit of his past virtue, that every second of his suffering is the fruit of his past non-virtue, and we'll talk about karma, we'll go into this, it's necessary to understand it deeply. It's just a sense of incredible accountability. So naturally, because he's not saying, why is this happening to me? That doesn't even arise in his mind, which means why he doesn't have anger. It's very powerful, and it was quite shocking to hear it. That's just natural for Tibetans who got the view of Buddhism, that is to say, you know. So they get on with dealing with the problem, because it's sort of, but we tend to think, well, you know, if you cause it, then you deserve it. We have this heavy punitive view. Well, you deserve it, then you know, get on with it. No, everyone deserves happiness. Everyone deserves whatever we get, in a sense. And Buddha's not talking about deserve. We use that concept. But what's fascinating is every second of whatever happens to us that is good, we never ask, why am I so fortunate? Why did I have a mother who had money in the bank? Why do I have a lovely daddy? Why, you know, have I got good health? Why have I got nice things happen? We only ask why the bad things happen, which says masses about our assumptions. So attachment is this hubris, this arrogance, this sense of entitlement that I only deserve the good things. And if I get them, it's my right, so why should I even bother? But how dare bad things happen? This sounds pretty shocking, but this is why we suffer terribly. These misconceptions, these philosophical views deep in the bones of our being, which we've practiced for eons, Buddha says, you know, attachment and aversion is quite profound. We've got to really unpack all this.
Venerable, are you saying then that when if we have an understanding of karma, then if we are working in social justice, it won't come from this kind of feeling of anger or...
No, it'll come from compassion. You know why it's happening, and you know that all these sentient beings are like you. They're suffering because of their own past actions, but they don't realize it. And they're having happiness because of their own past actions, but they don't realize it. We know that for ourselves. That's why on the Wisdom Wound, we have to know this deeply ourselves. And that informs our unbelievable compassion. And that's why you don't just have compassion for the innocent victims. You have compassion even more for the pedophile. And this is very shocking to say. Why? Because the victim has just finished their suffering and the pedophile is just beginning theirs. This is a very shocking view. And that is the logical deduction if you have the view of karma. So you have compassion for everybody and you help every sentient being because we're all in the same boat, all running around trying to find happiness and not get suffering, but increasing our suffering and diminishing our happiness because we have wrong views, Buddha says. So it takes time. It's outrageous to say it so bluntly, but we have to think about it, you know. That's why when you know, the bodhisattvas have such compassion. And the reason they have compassion for us, forget the ignorance of ego grasping, but they have compassion because we don't realize we are actually experiencing our own happiness and own suffering that we have caused every second, but frantically looking out there, wanting to know where it all is out there, like demented, can't see, you know. We are the cause. So you, and then you win, but you cannot have that compassion until you've done the wisdom work. Until you truly recognize karma, understood it for yourself, and understood your mind, until you've got some sense of renunciation of suffering and its causes, then it will naturally bring valid compassion, powerful compassion, and you'll never give up trying to help others because everyone's in the same boat. So it's not easy.
Yeah, because it can sound a little bit like we're an apologist for bad behavior or just trying to make ourselves feel comfortable about looking at the disasters in the world.
I've lost that one completely. Start again. Say
you know, if we think about how we have compassion for the, you know, the perpetrators.
Oh, okay, yep.
Then often, yeah, that's right. We become an apologist and go, oh, well, you know, they know not what they do kind of thing. And it's all...
But everybody knows not what they do, and that's the basis of compassion. And that doesn't... But we think, in our culture... When we look at a person who's just been harmed, if you see me punch Miffy, but you didn't see Miffy punch me the moment before, you'll have compassion for Miffy. But if you learn that Miffy punched me first, you'll go, well, she deserves it, doesn't she? That's how we think. But when we go past that deserve one, we are all being punched one life and then punching the next, endlessly changing roles, never ending in this cycle of punching and being punched. When we realize that, we will have compassion for both of us because we're both caught up in this demented view that I'm an innocent victim and I deserve it and I don't deserve whatever, you know? So when you have that view, it's not punitive. You have such compassion for yourself that you couldn't bear the thought of punching again. So when you see someone else punching, you realize this poor person doesn't realize, but it doesn't mean, well, they deserve it. Look at them. They deserve to be punched right back. No, you'll only have compassion for them because they don't realize, but that doesn't mean the poor. Okay. One point here is, I'll miss the point. If a person's, we will only have compassion for a person who seems innocent, who didn't look like they deserved it. That's the only person we're prepared to have compassion for, isn't it? Because we feel they don't deserve it. So our basis for compassion has to be innocence. Well, if you posit continuity of consciousness and you posit countless past lives and you posit that everything everyone does produces their own experiences, there's no issue of that. It doesn't even enter into it. There's not even a view of that. We just realize everyone's demented. Everyone's innocent victims. Everybody's not realizing that we're the cause of our own happiness and our own suffering. So you get this softness towards everybody. But then you, because of compassion, you will jump in and stop that guy from kicking the dog. But the reason is not just for the sake of the dog. It's for the sake of the guy as well, because you don't want him to create more negative karma. So it's a very different kind of thinking. It's not coming from, it's not apologizing for it. It's not thinking, oh, the poor fellow can't help it, pat him on the head. You know, he can't help it, the poor thing. He can't help, you know, jumping on little girls. No, you get him in prison as quick as you can. But the reason you prevent him from doing the pedophiles to jumping on little girls is as much for his sake as the little girls, because you don't want him to suffer with more negative karma. Like a mother for her child, Miffy. A mother for her child. Everybody else can't stand that junkie daughter. But she has such compassion for her daughter because she realizes her daughter is harming herself. That's the basis of compassion. And then you prevent them from harming. You prevent them from harming to protect them from harming and to protect the victim as well. But whereas if the other view we have is innocent victims and monstrous pedophiles, then it's set up for more anger and punitive and bitter and blame. It's a dreadful view.
So is that how we can actually begin to practice that? Because it's kind of okay to say, have compassion for the perpetrators, but not tolerance for their behavior.
But that's the point. You try to stop the, but the point is you don't just stop the guy from kicking the dog because you want to save the dog. You want to stop the guy from kicking the dog like a mother wants to stop her child being a junkie because she can't bear to see the pain she's causing herself. But we can't see that if we don't only have innocent victims. If we realize that everybody's in the same boat, everybody's driven by anger and jealousy. But it's very interesting. A good point about this is, we look at someone else being really brutal, like a pedophile, like a racist, like a maid, you know, and there are people out there who are doing terrible things. There's no argument about this. But we're so used to thinking if they're, you know, if the poor is due to their past actions, therefore they can't help it. We assume we have to feel sorry for them. That's not the issue at all here. I'm missing the point again. There's a very simple point I wanted to make and I lost the plot there. It's a much different view, this one. No, a mother. Okay. When we do the wisdom wing, what we're learning to do is control our body and speech because we don't want future suffering. Then we are going to see our minds and realize, look at the anger and look at the attachment and look at the jealousy and look at the depression. It is breaking my heart. I'm sick of this pain. You've got to have this is why renunciation isn't bitter, isn't blame, isn't against you. It's kindness to yourself because you're sick of this bloody suffering. You're sick of this pain, you know? You've really got a soft feeling, so you must give it up because you're fed up with suffering. If you don't have that, you can't move to the compassion wing properly. So the point is this: when we see our own anger and say jealousy, let's just say anger and jealousy, there's just two things we're both familiar with, we're all familiar with. When you realize, okay, in our lives, I guarantee everybody here in this place has done something to harm others. Everybody's been mean. Everybody has lied. Everybody maybe has stolen. Everybody has shouted. Someone's cheated on their boyfriend. Every one of us knows we've done something to harm others, even small actions. Now check. Did you harm somebody because you had love, compassion, patience, forgiveness, generosity? No. You did that because you were angry, hurt, attached, jealous, or depressed. It's so obvious. So when you own that anything you do to harm others is coming from that unhappy place in yourself, if you own that whatever you have done to harm others is coming from your delusions, then you can just simply look at a pedophile and multiply the delusions by 400 and know that's why he causes suffering. So you can't see the pain of a pedophile's mind until you've known your own mind. And that's our problem. We just look at the actions and we all act like we're saints. How dare that monster do that? Like as if you're some kind of saint, you know? So we have to know our minds deeply and well, and we have to see the attachment and the aversion and the jealousy and have to see the pain that it causes us. And that's why we do anything to harm others. If we don't get that, we can't have compassion for others. It's very simple.
So Venerable, how you said, like a mother looks at their junkie child or daughter, is that kind of the way that we do it then, is to think of everyone as our close family?
That's the way they talk in the Bodhisattva path, isn't it? That's exactly it. And that shows it really takes time to get there. I mean, that's why you can't just leap. And we don't even know about the wisdom wing. We don't even understand its relationship to ourselves. We all rush off and trying to be holy people and having compassion and wonder where we burn out and get exhausted because we're not qualified to have that level of compassion yet. It's not possible. That's why we get drained, because we at work, when we work for other people, we become exhausted. We get burned out because we're not aware of our own attachment and own anger. Why we suffer is not because of other people suffering. We suffer because of our attachment and our anger, and that's what's hard to see. And until we see that, we can't move an inch. Why do you think the Dalai Lama is such a happy guy? We should ask this question. It should blow our mind. 60 years of bloody, unbelievable suffering that Dalai Lama has had, hasn't he? And he's still a happy, funny guy who cracks jokes. We just go, oh, that's just the Dalai Lama. But please think it through. Here's an example. He's a proof of the pudding. It means he literally, and this is what's so shocking to us, We can't imagine how he doesn't suffer. When he sees the suffering of his people, he's not suffering, because suffering comes from attachment and anger and depression and ego grasping. He doesn't have that. If he is what he said to be, he doesn't have those delusions. He's free of them. So literally, he's not suffering. We don't understand suffering like that. We think suffering means seeing compassion, seeing racism, seeing dogs getting hurt. No, it's attachment that makes us suffer, because our attachment can't cope with the pain. That's why we can't cope with suffering. If we were bodhisattvas, we wouldn't have attachment. So the more suffering, the better. You're in there with all hands and you'll never give up and you'll never be depressed. And you'll never get upset and you'll never get angry. You'll be fierce and amazing in your compassion. You cannot have that until you get rid of attachment and anger, or even begin to understand them. Attachment and anger are why we suffer, not because people are suffering, not because the world is a sorry place, not because there's racism, not because of the environment, not because of all the animals being hurt, not because of the pedophiles. They are not why we suffer. We suffer because our attachment can't cope with it, because attachment is a junkie that only wants all the nice things. It can't stand problems. That's why we suffer. This is hard to see. It's intense. Oh, I got a hand from Laura.
Jan is asking, how do you reconcile compassion with punishment and the prison system and our legal system then?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely monstrous. I mean, you know, monstrous the way we think in the prisons. I see in America, it's just oneness with being punitive. People are just so much, I mean, everywhere it's the same. Anger drives this, because you better suffer, you know. I mean, that's the point. It's driven by anger. It's driven by anger and unforgiveness and anger. So, I mean, when it's driven like that, it's like a nightmare. And that's the American prison system, I have to say, with respect. And maybe Australia's going that way too. I mean, I remember reading about in Norway, you know, I remember I had a friend who emailed me, and he was emailing saying he was so looking forward to going to prison. Yet coming up soon was 2 years in prison in this nice country club in the country where he got education and healing, and he even got some money and he's going to study. He couldn't wait to get to prison. That's how prison should be. But we have to make them suffer. I see that when I go to American prisons. I cannot tell you. It's just driven by anger. It's driven by anger. And anger is they'd better suffer. And there's no forgiveness and there's nothing can change. It's monstrous. It's absolutely, and it's, that's why that's the philosophy of our world. It's so hideous, you know.
So we have this kind of addiction to anger, just like we do to attachment. If we totally, we want someone
else. Yeah, the righteousness of anger is so beyond shocking, isn't it? It's absolutely shocking. It's the you can see the killer that it is, you know. And that's why we get angry all the time. We never stop. I mean, listen to us. We never stop complaining about our politicians. Never, never stop complaining, saying negative words. Why do you think we're so distressed all the time? Why can't we sleep all the time? Because it's our anger. It doesn't mean the politicians are doing a good job. Giving up anger doesn't mean you become naive. But as Martin Luther King said, then you say, what can I do to help? And that's compassion. Then you become a fierce practitioner, you become a fierce political activist, but it's out of kindness and compassion, and you don't lose the plot. That's why when you hear Martin Luther King and John Lewis, these people so profound for 50-60 years, look at their suffering, and they did not have anger. It's unbelievable. It's very courageous. My friend in prison, Sunny, for 17 years treated like an animal, her husband slaughtered, head burst into flames, lost her children, terrible things happened. She did not have anger. She was fortunate. She was born that way. She was able to work on her mind and forgive and have love, and she became, and when I mean, I've met many former prisoners. And there's something emotionally stunted about them, because prison suffocates you, you know. You're treated like some moron, and especially if you've been wrongly accused. You can't imagine the nightmare of that. She was in this hell for 17 years. And she's like, when you meet her now, she's like a little old lady who does yoga. You would never recognize any. She doesn't have PTSD. Don't talk rubbish. And what? Because what PTSD is, post-traumatic stress syndrome. She doesn't, what is that? That's because you haven't dealt with the rage and the hurt, and it's buried deep inside you, and you've tried to push it away. It's going to keep coming out. You wouldn't, she doesn't have PTSD. You would not have PTSD if you work on your attachment and your aversion. That's the Buddha's view. You'd be a happy, smiling person. Why the hell do you think Dalai Lama's happy? He doesn't have PTSD. He should have, with the nightmare of his life and his people suffering every day. He doesn't have PTSD because he's dealing with his mind. There's nothing left over. They've gone past it. They finished. It's out, finished, gone. I mean, there's a friend of mine recently emailed me talking about his suffering and his memories from his past childhood, whatever happened, some trauma. And he said, well, his therapist said, well, you got to learn to live with it. You'll never get rid of it. I mean, how depressing can you get? The Buddhist view is there's nothing you can't change in your mind. Of course, it's hard work. But if ordinary people can, after living 17 years in hell in prison, and can come out and learn to practice love and compassion and kindness and teach yoga to people and learn to forgive, God in heaven, unbelievable, so powerful. It's possible. It's possible. So remember, we suffer not because of racism. We don't suffer because of COVID-19. We don't suffer because of horrible people and our ex-boyfriend. We suffer because we have attachment and aversion. And this sounds so stupidly naive, but it's profound, the Buddhist view how they talk. You know? So delve deep into this mind of ours, you know, and pull it out. And then we become a happy person and then brave and courageous, and nothing will disturb us then, for sure. But one step at a time. Don't hold your breath. If it's possible, is the main point.